The life of a Marine sniper is described in the new book Shooter, the autobiography of my guest, Sergeant Jack Coughlin. He recently retired from the Marines after fighting in Iraq. He also fought in the Gulf War, Mogadishu, and other hotspots. Journalist Peter Moss, who traveled with Coughlin in the 3rd Battalion in Iraq, wrote, "He's one of the best snipers in the Marine Corps, perhaps the very best. When I asked one of his commanders about his skills, the commander smiled and said, 'I'm just glad he's on our side.'" Sergeant Coughlin was one of the creators of a mobile sniper strike team, which he says enabled snipers to roam the battlefield and take the fight to the enemy instead of maintaining stationary positions. What do you see when you look out the sights of one of your sniper rifles?
When you look into the scope, you see a narrow view, obviously, because it tries to channelize your optimum view. But, you know, if I'm looking at a target at 700 yards, I can pretty much distinguish what that on that target's face, the expressions and stuff. The closer you get, the more you see.
So when you're shooting someone, you could actually see the expression on their faces when they get the bullet and die.
Yes, I unfortunately I've seen that.
And what impact does it have on you seeing this magnified view of them through your scope?
I mean, I've come to a way that when I'm in a fight, you know, in a combat situation, I don't think about it. It's a different situation. My brain slows down, and I'm just concentrating on doing the job, you know, protecting my fellow service members. After everything's done, and we're in a safe area, and the battle's over, that's when I get nervous, and then I have time to reflect on what I've done, and I take no pleasure in, you know, ending somebody's life.
Well, you describe in your book at least one example where after the battle was over, you went into a private place and had a very short little nervous breakdown and let loose with all of the things that you have to keep really under tight control when you're actually in battle.
Yeah, that's the way I've learned to deal with it. I, you know, keep everything inside and don't even really think about it until after the fact. And then, you know, when the wave of emotions just flood in, you know, you get rid of it, you know, and then you get ready to go back to work.
You're trained to see the people who you shoot at as targets, not as people who you're going to empathize with. I guess you can't really afford to have a lot of empathy when you're a sniper. You wouldn't be able to do your job effectively.
It's hard enough seeing them as people, but when you think of them as people, I don't know if there's anybody other than a homicidal maniac that could pull the trigger thinking in that. You know, I dehumanize them and think them as a target. I don't give them the respect they deserve as a human being until after it's done. And, you know, then I certainly reflect and I don't take, like I said, I don't take any pleasure in shooting anybody. I'm, you know, just unfortunately it's something that had to be done.
What was your first battle? Can you tell us what that was like?
The first kill you're talking?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you put your eye in the scope. It's really, actually the first time was probably the easiest. Because you don't know what the repercussions are. You know, you don't have the what I've just done feelings. And, you know, just like every other time, I had been, you know, practiced so much, it was a target to me. It wasn't a human being. It was a 623-yard shot. Centered it right on the chest, and, you know, right after the bullet went through, and I realized the target was dead, and then the situation permitted itself where it was safe and everybody around us was all right. That's when, you know, it really hit that. It was like, oh, my God, I just killed somebody.
Would you describe the battle that you were fighting in?
Yeah, it was an urban environment. I was in a hide site, which is, you know, places where we try to stay out of the enemy's view and be able to observe them at the same time. I was inside a third-story building in the back of a room, so I was completely in the shadows. And the enemy target was moving up from right to left into an area where we had friendly troops that were moving. And he had a RPK light machine gun, was getting ready to engage our people with it, so I had to take the shot.
Now, you say in your book that you actually met someone who you'd shot twice. I think this was in Iraq.
Yes.
You'd seen him fall. You didn't know he was still alive. How did you meet him, and did he know who you were?
Yeah, it was for the Battle of Adwanya. He was running from another right-to-left shot. Shot first round. Could have swore I hit him, but he just kind of buckled a little bit, took another shot, he went down, but he was in the defilade because of the terrain. I couldn't see him when he was laying down on the ground. It's a fast-moving battle. You look for other targets. You know, he was no longer a threat. then I went over, we were coming back through, and they reported they had a POW right there that was wounded twice. We went over there, and I mean, I saw who I shot in the scope, and it was him. And I used the translators to, you know, you have a chance to talk to him, and we brought him over and got him treated by our medical officer. And I actually gave him an Iraqi gas mask that we had picked up along the way because he didn't have one. And at that time, we, you know, we're pretty sure that there was weapons of mass destruction, so I wanted him to be taken care of, too.
What was that conversation? Go ahead.
I had no animosity towards him. I mean, I was glad that he survived. He was no longer a threat to us, and it was the first time that I ever shot somebody that I knew they lived. So to me, it was actually a happy moment. And he was a little strange talking to him because he knew I was the guy who shot him. And at first, I think he was, you know, he thought I was mad that he was still alive, you know. But after talking to him and giving him the gas mask, and, you know, he saw the treatment I was, you know, I was pushing. Not that they wouldn't have treated him anyways, but I was like, you know, I was looking over him like a, you know, a guardian or something, make sure, you know, I was taking care of him. So he was actually kind of joking about it after.
Were you surprised at your reaction?
No, because honestly, I know the type of person I am. I mean, no one values human life more than I do. And, you know, to me, there wasn't a threat anymore. I just wanted the best for him. I mean, I was there to help his country. I wasn't there to hurt them.
You describe in your memoir the story of the Diyala Bridge, in which Americans did shoot some civilians, and you witnessed that. What happened?
We had just taken the last bridge before we would actually get the chance to get into downtown Baghdad, so it was basically the last stand. It took us a whole day prior to take it. The thing was, it was an unstable position, so we couldn't set up roadblocks or anything because we were taking a lot of fire. So what we had to do is, as these vehicles started running down the road, would shoot into the engine blocks when they were about 700 yards away to warn them to stop. But, you know, there's a war going on. They're trying to get out of Baghdad. They don't want to be there when we hit Baghdad. You know, we're trying to get to Baghdad. We don't know if they're suicide bombers, too, like you said earlier. You know, we have to defend ourselves, too. And as they got closer, which we called a breakpoint, once they were within 300 yards, they were, you know, a legal target. So obviously, people, they kept going forward, and they got engaged. And it's the thing about war. I mean, war is the most horrible thing. People get killed, and innocent people get killed, and it's, no matter how much you try, it still happens. We didn't even use artillery to go across the bridge because we were worried about civilians. I mean, we've taken steps and put ourselves at risk to limit the chance of civilians being killed. I mean, that's a really big thing, because we went in there with the notion that we're there to, you know, liberate these people. They're our friends. We're not there to hurt them.
Do you find yourself almost getting angry at the civilians who are shot in situations like the one you just described, because, you know, angry because they didn't follow orders to, or they didn't understand orders to not proceed?
At that specific time, I blame them just as much as I blame myself. I was like, well, are you people stupid? If I'm getting shot at, I'm not going to drive at the person shooting at me. But, you know, that's a split-second thought I have, and they have a split-second decision. They don't know. They don't understand. And, you know, when you reflect, you know, you understand. They were scared. You know, they didn't know what the heck was going on. They weren't sure where they were getting shot at from. I mean, a lot of different aspects. But at the split-second time, I was so frustrated. It was just tearing me up.
You write in your book that after this incident in which you watched through your scope as civilians were killed, you write, my only thought was a faith-shaken prayer, oh my God, what have we done? Did you and the other Marines who were there that day talk about it afterwards? Is it the kind of thing you reflect on with people afterwards, or that you just reflect on privately?
Oh, no, we reflect on it because we try to learn. I mean, we're trying to figure out how we could avoid that mm-hmm. in the future. You know, we always trying to better ourselves in that area. Unfortunately for 99.9% of the people there that day, nobody had the view that I did. You know, I had the telescopic view, and they got to see the aftermath, but I got to see the live thing. And I don't explain that to them. That they don't need to know that.
You say that when you're actually in battle, that things slow down. Could you describe that sensation and when it's likely to start?
Well, the sensation is what you're feeling is it's like almost a total control or a concept of what's going on. Everything around you slows down, and the thing you're focusing on is like really clear and really sharp and really vivid. And everything explodes on you as far as the smells, this, you know, what you're seeing and hearing. And it starts like right when danger is imminent. As soon as it doesn't, you know, it's not like I'm walking around the country doing this every 20 seconds. It's as soon as I feel danger is imminent, all of a sudden things start to slow down. Sometimes it's a false alarm too. I mean, it doesn't mean that I always have action when it happens, but when I feel that imminent danger is coming, things really get, you know, a lot more clear.
My guest is Gunnery Sergeant Jack Coughlin. His life as a Marine sniper is described in the new book, Shooter. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Sergeant Jack Coughlin, and he has a new book called Shooter. It's a memoir of his life as a Marine sniper. As you say in your book, the eternal question is, what do you do with the warrior once the fighting is done? You actually retired from
Correct.
Being a sniper when you came home from Iraq. So what do you do now?
I'm retired fully from the Marine Corps about 2 months ago, and I'm basically just learning what it is to be a dad, you know, a single dad. I stay at home. I'm a stay-at-home dad. I raise my children. I'm writing. I enjoy spending time with them. To me, that, you know, is the essence of life. And what I've traveled a lot during their young lives, so I owe them a lot of time.
Do you still have guns, even though you're not at war anymore?
I haven't fired a weapon since I left Iraq. I didn't grow up firing guns. I never fired a rifle or a gun before I joined the Marine Corps, which is why I think I can shoot pretty decently, because they have a certain way of teaching you. I didn't have any bad habits, so I learned the right way the first time. I don't recreational shoot. To me, that was a job. I take no pleasure in it. You know, I play golf. And the only aspect I can use is the range estimation. I'm really good at telling you how far you are away from the pin. But I always tell my friends the wrong one, and they still beat me.
I know a lot of soldiers in battle dream of coming home to their family and how happy that reunion will be. When you came home to a divorce. And, I mean, did that hurt a lot? You know, you dream of what it's going to be like when you get home, and what happens when you get home, the news isn't good.
I'll describe it as my homecoming was taken away from me. I didn't have a homecoming. I did get to see my children. I mean, I obviously got to live with them again, and that was great. But immediately when I got off the bus at home, you know, there was no joyous reunion. It was, you know, more problems. You know, life doesn't deal you the best hand all the time. You got to play it the way you're dealt. And I was cheated, you know, that something that can never be replaced. That initial feeling when everybody has that great joy when they jump off the bus, I had nothing but sorrow. And, you know, I regret that. And I feel cheated over that. I miss that.
You are very well trained, and it sounds like you've been really effective during your years as a sniper, of not letting your emotions interfere with the work and not letting empathy interfere with being able to shoot the people you had to shoot. Now that you're retired, is any of that coming back at you? Is any of those feelings that you were able to put to the side kind of surfacing, either in waking moments or in dreams?
There's not a day that goes by that I don't think about the people that I've had to kill. And that's when I was on active duty here. So it hasn't came up anymore. It hasn't gone away any less either. You know, I have dreams frequently, but they're not nightmares. I mean, I remember, you know, what I've done. I see them in my dreams, but they're not haunting me. It's kind of like we're all there together and, you know, just trying to figure things out. As far as daydreaming and stuff, you know, you think about it, you reflect. I mean, this whole hour we've been talking, obviously I'm reflecting on everything I've done. But, you know, I'm not haunted by it. Because I think because I don't feel pride in what I've done. I'm not happy with myself for doing it. So the guilt might be a little less there because of that.
I understand what you're saying. But it sounds like, I mean, you're proud of your skill. You're proud of having been effective at what you've done, but not proud not glad that that entails taking other lives.
That's right. I am. I mean, I am proud of my status as a Marine. I'm proud that I was a Marine. I'm proud that I defended our country. I'm proud that I'm good at what I did in battle because it saved lives. Unfortunately, the downside of that is the way I saved lives, I had to take lives. So that I take no pride in that.
Sergeant Coughlin, thank you so much for talking with us, and I wish you good luck.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Sergeant Jack Coughlin's new autobiography is called Shooter.